This is Law and Disorder.
Every day in this country, children are bombarded with clever and frequently deceptive advertising from corporate giants such as McDonald's and Mattel. Increasingly, advertisers are partnering with schools and even trusted civic organizations and nonprofits. The goal is to raise children as loyal and ideal consumers. We talk about this trend and efforts to counter it with Josh Golan from the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. We get an update on the ever-changing Greek debt crisis.
A four-month debt deal was just reached. Is that good for the people of Greece? Or is it just a continuation of austerity?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, last week a jury came down with a rather astonishing decision in a so-called terrorism case involving Palestinian activists.
Last week I gave a report or an update on this case, which hadn't reached verdict. Well, now it's reached verdict, and the verdict was astonishing. And of course, the Israeli lobby, the Zionists, a whole bunch of people are celebrating this as a great victory over the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinians. The Palestinian Authority, the government of Palestine, was found liable for $218.5 million for the killing of a number of U.S. citizen civilians in Israel in 2002 to 2004. That amount of damages, $218.5 million, is trebled under the special anti-terrorism law, an anti-terrorism law passed really in part, if not specifically, so that Israelis could sue Palestinians. In any case, treble to $655.5 million. And what I said last week applies again and again. It's the equivalent of trying the ANC in South Africa during apartheid, or the Algerians in Paris during the Algerian struggle for liberation. While the United States isn't Israel, for this purpose, it might as well be. They're tied at the hip.
Michael, is this purely a symbolic decision? There's no expectation that this money's really going to be paid, is there?
Well, I think this is very tricky, extremely tricky, for a couple of reasons. One is, to the extent there's assets of the Palestinian Authority, they may be able to get some of those, whether here or try and get that judgment in other places. I'm not sure that's their best course. Their best course is there's two sources of money for the Palestinian Authority. One comes from Israel, from the customs receipt that the Palestinians are entitled to, because it's their customs receipts for goods that pass back and forth over the border. And yeah, that's hundreds of millions of dollars that could be held up. And the U.S., maybe not known to a lot of our listeners, gives a certain amount of money. I think it's up to $400 million a year to the Palestinian Authority for its own survival. But it's certainly a big number, $100 million or something else. You're sitting here with Republican Congresses on both sides, on the Senate and the House side, and what do you think they're going to do with a judgment like this? I mean, this judgment's going to go up on appeal, we'll see what happens, etc. But here you're talking about Congress is going to be saying, why should we pay money to the Palestinian Authority if they're not paying the families of Americans killed in these attacks? And it's actually happened before, where these kind of judgments have happened, whether in the Cuba case or in the Israel case. They make deals with the lawyers for the plaintiffs, and they actually get a certain amount of money. So this is not a completely hypothetical judgment. And, of course, the Israelis want to use it to say, oh, see, the Palestinian Authority is a terrorist state, they're terrorists, and whatever you're going to go against this in the International Criminal Court, they've already been labeled a terrorist by a U.S. court.
In the court proceedings that led up to this judgment, Michael, was there actual proof that the Palestinian Authority murdered people on the streets of Israel?
Completely weak. I mean, very weak. So weak as to not sustain it. I mean, they had these arguments that some of the people in prison had received, or their families had received money after the people were imprisoned, and the Palestinians imprisoned had been accused or convicted of some of these killings. But their families got money after the fact for support when their husbands or fathers or brothers were in prison is hardly the stuff of which liability is made. And there was the issue raised, these were these people were convicted by the military courts in Israel. And so the argument that the defense lawyers made, what good are these convictions? This is a completely corrupt judicial system. You know, you can't go forward with this. So there wasn't a lot of evidence at all. In fact, really, I would have to say none.
Was the defense allowed to put in evidence of the number of Palestinians who were killed by the Israelis?
Not at all, but you saw plenty of crying on the witness stand, not wrongly, by people whose loved ones had been killed. But I kept thinking to myself, in the last war in Gaza, and there's been three in the last decade, in the last war, 500 children were killed, civilian children, 500 people. Every one of those mothers, fathers of those kids could have been on that witness stand, but none ever will be in an American court.
If the Palestinians try to bring a lawsuit against the Israelis in the International Criminal Court for that massacre, you think they'll ever accomplish that?
I like to think about the Palestinian case, or the case against Palestine here, in the context of all the other times we've tried to get Israel liable for what it's done, whether in Gaza, the occupied territories, or in Israel itself. And I just made a quick note. One was a case against Avi Dichter. Avi Dichter was a general responsible for dropping a one-ton bomb on a house in Gaza, killing 14 civilians. We got thrown out of court here. Second case, we represented the American citizen, Turkish young man, 19 years old, killed on the Gaza flotilla. Do you think we could get anywhere in an American court, even though he was an American citizen? Absolutely not. Zero. A third case we brought was, of course, for Rachel Corrie, the young woman killed by a Caterpillar bulldozer. We sued Caterpillar. What was the defense? The defense was not that they didn't kill her, that a bulldozer wasn't known to be used to demolish houses and create war crimes. No. The defense was that those bulldozers were exported to Israel pursuant to a U.S. license, and therefore it would be interference by the court to look into the fact of how Rachel Corrie was killed or that the bulldozers might be being used for war crimes. So you basically wind up with a big zero no matter what you do in the United States. And of course, as you said, in the International Criminal Court, we'll see now, because there is actually some push now. Palestine will become a member of the court on April 1st. There'll be papers filed in the ICC by many people we know, and we'll have to see if they have the guts to actually take on somebody besides an African dictator.
Michael, final question in this jury decision. Will it be appealed?
Yes, it will definitely be appealed. Let's hope something happens on that. But I got to tell you, we're in the, you could call it the Second Circus, but we're in the Second Circuit in the city of New York. And they already went up to try and stop the trial on a couple of issues. One was, as I talked about last time, why isn't the Palestinian Authority granted immunity like Israel is in the U.S. courts? And that's because of the 134 countries that recognize Palestine as a state. The United States does not. And therefore, in our courts, it doesn't get immunity. Israel does. They didn't really lose on that completely yet in the courts, but ultimately, I'm afraid they will.
The National Football League, Mattel's Girl Scouts Barbie doll, and even McDonald's all have something in common. They've engaged in highly sophisticated corporate marketing aimed at enticing young children to become lifelong consumers and brand loyalists. And they're the subjects of efforts by the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood to cease clever marketing that sends the message that purchasing will make children happy. The campaign has a proven track record of educating families and the public at large about how industry partnerships with schools, nonprofits, and trusted institutions such as the Girl Scouts expose young people to inappropriate content with potentially negative consequences. Here to talk in more detail about the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood is Associate Director Josh Golan. His writings about the commercialization of childhood have appeared in a wide range of publications. Josh Golan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
I am a huge fan of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. I just love your organization, and I wanted to give an overview to our listeners of some of the campaigns that you are doing now and some of the successes you've had before we talk about the issue of internet privacy vis-a-vis young persons. But I notice on your website that you have a campaign against a Barbie and the Girl Scouts, getting McDonald's out of the schools, and a Tell Lego, Don't Let Shell Pollute Our Kids' Minds. Can you give us a brief overview of what these campaigns are about?
Sure. Very unfortunately, the Girl Scouts, which has traditionally been such a wonderful organization and at providing leadership models and role models for girls, launched a partnership last year with Barbie. And this partnership includes a website where girls can play a game, a Barbie game, about choosing careers. But really all they're doing is looking at different Barbie outfits and seeing different Barbie dolls that they can buy in the store. And then there's even a Barbie patch that Girl Scouts can earn for their uniforms by playing this game online. And then this past summer, the Girl Scouts and Barbie came out with a Girl Scout Barbie doll. So we just thought that, you know, that this was such a harmful campaign to young girls, that the Girl Scouts has traditionally been a refuge from the commercialism that is aimed at kids everywhere, and clearly Barbie represents a very problematic body type and a focus on appearance and fashion, which is really, in some ways, the antithesis of what the Girl Scouts have traditionally represented. So we launched a campaign calling for the Girl Scouts to end this partnership. They haven't done that yet, but we have gotten just tremendous feedback from people around the country, including many Scout leaders and Girl Scouts themselves calling on the Girl Scouts to do this, to end the partnership. So we're hopeful that, at the very least, that this will prevent future partnerships like this.
Now, Josh, what would the Girl Scouts get out of such a partnership?
Oh, I guess I neglected to mention that they got $2 million from Mattel for this partnership. And so basically what they did in exchange for a large, quote-unquote, donation to the national organization, they provided advertising access to the Girl Scouts, to their members.
So it's essentially a co-branding partnership. And I understand that they introduced a Barbie Girl Scout that wears pink capris, high heeled hiking boots.
Yeah, you know, it's absolutely it's just an amazing looking doll, which would be funny if it wasn't. You know, I mean, it is funny in a way, but you know, the messages that it sends to girls that you need to look like a fashion doll even when you're out in the woods or going on a hike is just unbelievable.
Tell us about your McDonald's campaign, and I understand this isn't. Am I wrong? This isn't the first campaign that you've had that involves McDonald's.
No, we've done a number of campaigns involving McDonald's. In fact, one of the campaigns that we did several years ago, which was a very successful campaign, was when McDonald's was advertising on students' report cards in Florida. And what happened was that we got contacted by a parent who, her daughter came home and she said, "Mom, I got straight A's. That means you have to take me to McDonald's." And the mother said, "But what are you talking about?" And there, on the envelope that the report card came in, was an ad for McDonald's saying, "Bring your report card to McDonald's if you got good grades or had good attendance or even good behavior, and you get a free Happy Meal." And this mother was just outraged that McDonald's would be dictating what the reward for her daughter would be and that they would be promoting junk food in this way. And so we launched a campaign around that and got a huge amount of attention and really shamed McDonald's. And so they ended up ending that advertising program, which was a great victory for parents and for kids. This past year, what we've been focusing on, it was very interesting. Last year at the McDonald's shareholder meeting, the then recently deposed CEO of McDonald's said, "We are very responsible in our advertising. We don't put Ronald McDonald into schools." And we were shocked when he said this, because we knew, in fact, that Ronald McDonald does, in fact, regularly visit schools. And what he does is, the idea is schools contract with their local McDonald's, and Ronald McDonald comes in and he'll talk about reading or exercise or being a good friend. But really what it is, it's a very highly branded program where kids are seeing Ronald McDonald, and the first thing that they associate with Ronald McDonald, of course, is going to McDonald's. Jumping off of the fact that the CEO had said something that was clearly not true, we launched a campaign. We got about 48 international health and advocacy organizations to sign on to a letter asking McDonald's to keep its word not to send Ronald McDonald into schools. And then we've had about 15,000 parents have then co-signed that letter and have called on McDonald's to stop this practice.
I just am looking at some of the things you've successfully done in the past, and again, some of them are, come across, you can laugh at them, but they're pretty serious things when you're really understanding that we are marketing to even babies or toddlers, that these campaigns implicate issues such as, you know, childhood obesity, eating disorders, body image, and sexualizing childhood. I see that you prevented Hasbro from producing a line of dolls for six-year-old girls based on the Pussycat Dolls. That's a burlesque troupe that turned singing group known for its sexualized songs and dances. And then bus radio, I guess I haven't been in school for so long that I didn't know how pervasive advertising on school buses or in classrooms is.
Yeah, that's an area that we do a lot of work on, is around advertising in schools, and it's really an unfortunate trend. And there's been an increase in it since 2008 when we had the economic downturn, and you know, schools are understandably looking for revenue any way they can get it. But unfortunately, one of the solutions that they're turning to is allowing advertisers into classrooms and on school buses. And it's really unfortunate. First of all, it doesn't even do a dent to solve budget problems. And we've done research, and for instance, school districts that advertise on their school buses, on average, they're making between $1 to $2 per student per year. So if you think about, you know, taking this great symbol of education, a school bus, and the first thing that a student sees in the morning and the last thing they see in the afternoon when they're leaving for the day, and plastering it with advertisements, and in return you're only getting $1 or $2 for what that student sees, that's just beyond being exploitative, it's just a terrible business decision. But anyway, there has been this increase in marketing into kids in schools, and we think that, you know, that's particularly harmful to children. One, because anything advertised in the school comes with the school's endorsement, but also because one of the best defenses that we have for children with advertising is the ability to not look at it, to turn off the television, to not go online, to go outside and play. And when you're in a school, it becomes mandated. Seeing an advertisement becomes a mandated part of your school day. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that corporations love to advertise to kids in schools, is because they know that their message will be seen and that it will come with the school's endorsement.
So, right. They're a captive audience. And in a way, it has the imprimatur of the educational system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we send our children to school with the idea that the messages, the materials that they see will be chosen because they're in our kids' best interest, not because somebody can pay more to get their brand in front of our kid when they're in school.
Josh, I was interested to see that the campaign has issued a report called Out of Bounds, the NFL's intensive campaign to target children. Now, I had no idea. I know that football games are a big advertising for cars and Budweiser beer, but tell us about some of the findings of how the NFL targets children. I understand that they work in some cases with nonprofits.
They do. And so what the NFL has really done is, because they know that their biggest lifetime fans are people who become interested in football when they're in elementary school or younger, and because fewer kids are now playing football because of concerns about concussions, the NFL has started to market itself to kids the same way that other brands like Disney and McDonald's do. And what that means is that they are really trying to infiltrate nearly every aspect of kids' lives. So they have a website for children that's just filled with video games and contests, and they even produce their own cartoon that is shown on Nickelodeon, which is basically just a half an hour commercial for the NFL and its players. And then they also do a lot of marketing in schools, and they partner, as you mentioned, with prominent government agencies like the USDA and the American Heart Association. And what's interesting about those partnerships is those partnerships allow the NFL to market extensively to school children, because the stated purpose of these programs is to promote healthy eating and physical exercise. But at the same time they're doing that, the NFL is marketing endless amount of video games and its broadcasts and other forms of screen time that really undermine the any exercise messages that kids are getting from the league. And they partner with junk food companies like McDonald's and Pepsi and Frito-Lay to market junk food extensively to kids. So when it's convenient for the NFL to promote exercise and healthy eating, they do so because that gets their brand in front of the kids. And when it's convenient for them to promote junk food and video games, they do the same thing. But really what it's all about is getting that lifetime brand loyalty. And I think, you know, one of the things that's most concerning about what the NFL does is they market fantasy football extensively to kids. They even have a curriculum for schools to teach kids about fantasy football, where they can then go online to the NFL's kid website and compete for cash prizes. And research shows that the earlier kids get involved in gambling-related activities, and fantasy football really is a gambling-related activity, particularly if you're playing for money, the more likely they are to be problem gamblers.
This is fascinating. I had never heard of fantasy football before. But I noticed that they've also, the NFL has produced branded teaching materials for elementary school classrooms with vocabulary words in one set of lesson plans, even though it's supposed to be teaching math and language arts. But they're football terms like huddle or quarterback. I guess The lesson is that they're trying to build consumer brand loyalty at a very early age that stays with these children for life.
Absolutely. They're trying to do it. And unfortunately, I think in part because people don't necessarily recognize it in the same way they would if it was a more recognizable corporate entity, they're doing it with the help of these trusted nonprofits, and they're doing it with the help of teachers. I mean, as you mentioned, the curriculum that they're asking teachers, or they're telling teachers, teaches language arts and math. You know, what it teaches about is football, and you know, they have a curriculum that's designed to get kids to watch their cartoon on Nickelodeon, and that's what it teaches kids, is that what time and what channel the NFL's cartoon is on.
One of the things I wanted to mention is that the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood turned down a nearly $200,000 settlement from Facebook. And I'd like to know why, and if you could briefly tell us about that and how it fits into sort of the privacy issue.
So we were selected to be a CyPrey recipient from a lawsuit. And what that means is a lot of times when a lawsuit is settled between class action lawyers and a company, they pick nonprofits to get part of that settlement. And so we were selected to receive some money from that, and it was a considerable windfall for a nonprofit with a very small budget, and we were very excited. But when we started looking into the settlement, we realized that it was a very bad settlement, and that the privacy protections that are purported to give kids and teenagers were actually largely illusionary. And we realized that we couldn't be part of Facebook has some very, very serious privacy issues, and we couldn't be part of a settlement that papered over those issues. So what we did is we turned down the money, and we not only turned down the money, but we publicly opposed the settlement, which is the first time that a group that had been selected to receive one of these CyPrey awards had ever publicly opposed the settlement, which led to a lot of publicity about how it was a bad settlement and also about Facebook's privacy policies. You know, privacy is an enormous issue for all of us these days, and not just from, you know, the standpoint of the government and what they're looking at, but that, you know, essentially all of our activities online are being looked at and being stored, and profiles are being built of us, and so that they can deliver more effective marketing. And that's really concerning when we're talking about, it's concerning when we're talking about any of us, frankly, but when we're talking about kids, it's particularly concerning. Kids who have no idea about what's happening to them and for who this targeted marketing is particularly effective because they don't even understand how it's recognizing who they are and delivering them these messages. So we do a lot of work around trying to get stronger privacy regulation to protect children and also to make sure that the information that schools are collecting on kids, you can imagine how much information that schools have about children. And marketers want to get their hands on this information, and in some cases they do get information on kids through schools. And so it's really important that we develop strong privacy, student privacy protection so that kids' educational records aren't used to market to them.
And I think it's worth noting that much of the advertising and the branding that we're seeing is in the form of animated or fantasy characters, animals, things that appeal to young children who can't at that age properly differentiate between reality and fantasy.
Absolutely. So much. I mean, one of the things about the commercialization of childhood is that the companies and the marketers employ psychologists who understand child development so they can target their ads very carefully to specific age groups. And as you say, often this marketing takes place to age groups who don't really understand advertising, who aren't developmentally ready to understand what an ad is trying to do to them. And so they treat that information the same way they would treat it if they got it from a trusted source like an adult or a teacher. And that's one of the reasons why to advertise to young children, particularly children under the age of 8, it's just fundamentally unfair because until a child understands what an advertisement is, they don't really have the developmental capability to defend themselves against it.
Josh, it's been a real pleasure to have you on and to talk about your organization and the work you're doing. I'm not going to tell listeners what the Toady Awards are, but I'm going to hope they'll go to your website and find out. And we look forward to hearing more in the future of your very ethical approach to organizing against these campaigns and to continued success.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Earlier this year, we reported on the historic election, which voted in Greek anti-austerity coalition party Syriza. Syriza's platform is to simply end the austerity, which has created a crisis in Greek society, austerity which was imposed on the Greeks by the Germans principally and their allies throughout Europe. Their program called for cancellation of their debt, nationalization of the Greek banks, and expropriating closed factories. Greece is a member of the Eurozone, the nations that have joined in together with a common currency since 1999. Now, after barely a month in office, the Syriza party, led by Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, has been forced to make huge concessions on major issues, such as labor reforms and the continued privatization of public property. Last week, Syriza entered negotiations with the European Union and the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund and secured a 4-month extension on its financial rescue. To get an update on the Greek debt crisis, we're joined today by Natina Vagantzis, a Greek-American PhD student in sociology at NYU, who is focusing on political economy and social movements. Natina, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Last week, things got real dramatic in Greece with the imposition by the Europeans, particularly the Germans, on the austerity program that the Greek people are trying to wiggle out of. And we'd like you to teach us, how did the Greek population get into the terrible straits that they're in? And what are the Germans and the other European allies of the Germans trying to keep doing to the Greeks? And how do the Greeks possibly get out from under this?
So let's start with December 2009, which is when the Greek government declared that it had sovereign debt of 109%, which is something that they had been covering up the past few years.
What does that mean, 109%?
It means that they were running, budgetary deficits. And
100% would be they had the same amount of debt as they had of money.
GDP, exactly.
Right, or GDP.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
109% means they're bankrupt, essentially.
Exactly. Okay. So Goldman Sachs also was involved with helping them cover up those figures.
That's right.
And of course, we should look at a little bit more historically the political economy of the Eurozone, which is that the Eurozone was constructed in the early 2000s, right? And at the same time in Germany, what you had was wage suppression, which means that the working class of Germany was getting lower wages so that German exports would become more competitive. And the European periphery was used kind of as a dumping post for all these German exports. And so they were getting more lending from, German banks and other banks in the European core. And that's why you started getting more debts in Greece.
Let me see if I understand that. Germany suppressing its wages, which was always interesting to me. I didn't know that. I always thought Germany had high productivity because they paid a lot of wages, but they still had high productivity. But in fact, Germany has, if you look at a graph, the wages are going down.
Since the 90s, yes. Right.
And then what they did is they would loan money to places like Greece so they could buy German products.
Exactly.
And therefore, Greece goes way up in debt.
Exactly.
Okay.
And, this wasn't only happening at the individual consumer level, but also at the level of the government. The government was getting into contracts with, for instance, companies like Siemens, and you have documented cases of bribery between Greek officials and Siemens officials. So, right, this was happening from the bottom to the up, mainly at the up, which is what was causing, these large debt figures. And so in 2009, the government declares that these figures exist. And then in 2010, it starts entering into negotiations, not even negotiations. It was, a one bam bam situation where it says with the EU, the IMF and the ECB, known as the Troika, that it's going to enter into this memorandum of agreement.
Tell us what those initials mean.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The European Union, the European Central Bank, and then the International Monetary Fund, which has played its hand, as since the 70s in imposing discipline on countries throughout the developing world. And Greece was really the first so-called advanced country that was starting to enter into this regimen of so-called structural reforms that were attached to these bailouts that Greece was receiving to deal with the debt issue.
Those three places you mentioned, IMF, ECB, and
the European Union.
Those three started imposing some conditions on Greece.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. And you could say that they were imposed, but also they were agreed to by the Greek government at the time. At that time, the Greek government was run by PASOK, the center-left party. But of course, it was unsustainable because attached to these structural reforms is the termination of collective bargaining agreements, the reduction of minimum wage, even more importantly, unemployment rising to 25%. So you have massive social degradation. And at the same time, the debt continues to rise. So the debt went from 109% of the GDP to now it's 175% of the GDP. So Greece is basically getting loans so that it can pay interest on interest starting in the early 2020s. And Syriza rightly identified this as an extended pretend strategy so that in 2015, when the government was unable to get an election of its own president, Syriza took the initiative based on, increasing support that it received starting in 2012 to call for elections and to run on an anti-austerity platform.
Let me go back for one second. What happens in 2010 is they impose austerity on it.
Exactly.
Which you just went through. Now, austerity is based on the fact the government shouldn't spend as much money because they need that money to pay back the debt.
Exactly. What they say, balancing budget. So Greece had to run primary surpluses.
And then what happens
is there's a political party comes out of this. Tell us a little bit about that political party. You mentioned the word.
Yeah. So Syriza, right, is the coalition of the radical left. That's what it's translated into Greek. And it comes out of various left tendencies that in the early 2000s, in the midst of anti-globalization movements, anti-war movements, came together and said, let's, you know, build this parliamentary coalition. Through the 2000s, they participated in various social movements. You know, Syriza was always part of the left that embraced social movements, which is different from the more traditional left in Greece, most infamously represented by the KUKUE, the Communist Party of Greece. For instance, in 2008, when youth started taking to the streets after cops killed the 15-year-old Alexis Grigoropoulos, the KKE was very suspicious of this kind of movement, even treated the activists as just petty bourgeois troublemakers. Syriza said, no, these youth are expressing real problems in the country, not just with police brutality, but with the fact that there's high youth unemployment. So Syriza was really able to build its base from the ground there. It also had a lot of people who had come from the Euro-communist tendency in Greece, which has to do with a split with the Communist Party in the 1960s, and we won't get into that history. But basically, you know, Greece has had a very lively political culture. The left, even though being suppressed, you know, since the post-war period, it was illegal up until 1974 after the fall of the dictatorship, was able to retain its bases. And so starting in 2012, Syriza really became more electorally oriented when, you know, and during those elections in May and June, very critical elections, Alexis Tsipras, who's the leader of the Greek party, said, look, you know, we want to build an anti-austerity coalition of the left. And so he invited other parties of the left to join this coalition. And unfortunately, it was a bit hard to build that due to very sectarian tendencies on the Greek left. But nevertheless, they continued, and because they rose so quickly in those elections, they viewed this as a sign that they should start preparing for government. You know, they were the opposition government between 2012 and the end of 2014. And then, of course, in 2015, they got about 35% of the vote, which wasn't enough to form a government on its own, which is why it had to form a coalition government with ANEL, Independent Greeks, which is actually a right-wing anti-austerity party, which people have had, you know, various suspicions about. I myself think that at that point, given what the situation was, it was kind of a necessary coalition that they had to make, and they found different ways to neutralize the more right-wing tendencies of that party. But of course, as the party is going to have to face various pressures in this conjuncture, you're going to see that, you know, maybe this coalition is going to start creating difficulties for Tsipras.
Michael, I have one question on the debt before we get there, just an explanatory thing, because it was 109% of GDP, which is essentially bankrupt. And then it goes, you said, to 179% despite the austerity measures.
Exactly.
And just give us a quick explanation. Isn't austerity meant to, like, decrease the debt that they owe to outside creditors?
Yeah, right. This is one of the fallacies of austerity, that if you're going to contract the economy, then the government's going to have money to start paying off its debt. But when you contract the economy, the government doesn't have money. So how is it going to pay off its debt? Everyone knows that the Greek government can't pay its debt until the early 2020s.
Nantina, Syriza ran on a platform that really gave a lot of hope to the Greek people and to their supporters like us here in America, because they said, we want to get rid of the debt, we want to create some jobs, we want to get food for people, electricity for people, stop mortgage foreclosures. They had a 40-point platform that was really thrilling to read. And then they go into these negotiations with the Germans and the Troika, and it seems to me that they came out with very little. And I wanted to ask you, what were their expectations, and where does it stand now?
Yeah, so you identified exactly what their platform was. It was to reverse austerity and to renegotiate the debt. It's different than canceling the debt unilaterally. Syriza went into these negotiations saying that we're not going to make unilateral moves. For instance, if the talks fail, we're not going to leave the Eurozone unilaterally. And actually, if you want to get into analysis of why they didn't get as much as people were expecting, it's because, in my opinion, they didn't have this kind of unilateral strategy. You know, I've written a piece in the Jacobin saying that I don't think the Eurozone would take any chances to let Greece leave the Eurozone because of, you know, the things that I said earlier, how helpful it has been, especially to German capital, right? They're not willing to take that long-term risks. They're not willing to take the short-term risk of speculative attacks that would occur on the Eurozone. You know, a Greek exit could have induced a domino effect where perhaps Portugal would have left, Italy, you start having big economies like Spain leaving. You know, that kind of domino effect would be unsustainable for the Eurozone to exist. So I think that, you know, Tsipras, Varoufakis, when they went into the negotiations, they could have had a more heavy-handed card in saying, look, if you don't, you know, accept our very, you know, reasonable demands to not just stop austerity, but to start promoting growth, not just in Greece, but in the entire Eurozone, where you've had a depression in most economies there, then look, we're going to take more unilateral actions. It wasn't ready to play that card. And so what we got was two very big commitments and then, you know, some more subsidiary things. The one big commitment was that it wouldn't reverse austerity unilaterally, meaning that every measure that the Greek government is going to take now, the Troika will approve week by week.
Yeah, so the Greeks have no control over the austerity.
Exactly. Yeah, they have no fiscal space is the more, you know, euphemistic way of saying it. And the
so
second
what that means is the first one, when saying reverse austerity or push it back, let's say you wanted to increase minimum wage because they may have required you to be at a certain wage. Then the Troika, as you refer to them, and the three organizations are, say them again.
The EU, the IMF, and the ECB.
Has to approve any kind of changes in the austerity program.
Exactly. There are some things that the Troika allowed when they submitted this reform list, and that included, just as you said, some things around electricity, you know, very basic anti-poverty measures, food stamps, things like that. But, you know, these bigger things, like increasing the minimum wage, like reversing the concessions that the Greek government had made around pensions, even, you know, universal health care, which is something that the Greek government has committed to now, they don't have, you know, actual budget items that they've stick to that in the reform items. This is something that the Troika will have to approve. So that's the first concession that they made. And I'll just say the second one that they made is that they're committing to primary budget surpluses of 4.5% in 2016, which means, again, that that's a very, very limited space in order to reverse austerity. You know, these intentions that they had earlier, and they had kind of an itemized list of where they would get the money to fulfill, you know, the 40-point program that you're talking about, the Thessaloniki program. Now that's going to be very difficult. And in 2015, the one concession you can say that the Troika gave was that, you know, given the economic circumstances, they might give some leeway over that. But again, this is a very political game, so we can't rely on those kinds of statements.
Yeah, one of the things that horrifies me is that the Troika is continuing to insist that the Greek government sell off its public ownings, like, you know, sell a park, you know, sell a water supply. I mean, and the Greek people have no control over that either. So now it seems that the can has been kicked down the road, that these negotiations will continue 4 months from now. If you were active as a political woman in Greece tomorrow, what would you start doing in terms of trying to protect people against what might happen to them 4 months from now?
Well, I would echo the call that Stathis Kouvelakis, who's a leading member of the Left Platform, which is basically the institutionalized left wing in Syriza, he's on their central committee, on the party central committee, and he said that this is a defeat of the strategy of the good euro. Right, that you're going to your partners in the European Union and the European Central Bank and saying that, look, we all believe in a Europe of growth. We all believe in a Europe of political cooperation. We don't want the far right to take power, neither in Greece nor in the, you know, nor in France or wherever else. And so we're going to agree to more reasonable policies in Greece. We're going to even, you know, give debt reduction to Greece in the same way that we gave debt reduction to Germany, full debt relief, actually, in the 1954 Congress. We're going to have a similar kind of New Deal that we had after
Who's
World War
this?
II. You know, this was the policy or the strategy that Syriza's leadership had in going into the negotiations, approaching Europe as a partner. It turned out that the EU and the ECB don't want to be partners, right? They want to continue implementing this very hard line of austerity. And so I'm echoing Stathis Kouvelakis' call for a revisit of that strategy of the good euro and having to say, look, we might actually have to move unilaterally if you guys don't give us some fiscal autonomy. We might consider, you know, Grexit, which is Greece leaving the eurozone. And, you know, that, of course, has a lot of immediate implications.
One
the Greek
second
government...
on that. What you're saying is that there's, within the left wing of Syriza, and you have to say the name slowly because it's a Greek name.
Yes.
There's a person in there who probably represents some constituency saying that we may have to leave the eurozone. What's his name for slowly?
His name is Stathis Kouvelakis, and he's on the central committee of Syriza. Now, there are people who are also on the parliamentary team of Syriza. There is the well-known economist Kostas Lapavitsas, and he is an elected MP now in Syriza, and he had been talking about, you know, Greece leaving the Eurozone for 4 or 5 years at this point. He's just released a book on Verso as well, Against the Troika, which is actually a blueprint for how Greece and other peripheral economies could leave the Eurozone. So there are ways of dealing with this, right? You would have to impose capital controls, you would have to nationalize the banks, which is something that Syriza's leadership said that they wouldn't do prior to the elections. They're going to have to revisit that strategy. Then you would have to figure out how you would ration food, fuel, pharmaceuticals in order to deal with these immediate problems. And then you would have to start talking about very long-term policies that would promote growth. And one of those that I talked about in my piece in Jacobin is one of industrial policy. And really, you know, not just confronting the Euro elite, but confronting the Greek elite and saying, hey, you guys who have gotten contracts so easily in this, you know, post-war period, you're now going to have to start to be disciplined in order to get contracts with our airwaves, with our real estate, with our stadiums. You know, there's a section of Greek capital that now can't really leave Greece. People always talk about the fear of ship owners leaving, and that's the only section of Greek capital. That's not the only section of Greek capital. You have other sections that are reliant on, as I said again, real estate, airwaves, stadiums, and they're the ones who the Greek government can take a firm line against. So I think, you know, moving forward, Syriza needs to, you know, start listening to its left wing a little bit more. You know, they haven't had a central committee meeting since early January. And even then, it was quite hostile between the leadership and the central committee. So they need to start, you know, being more democratic in the party again. They cannot move toward a technocratic approach. You know, then they would lose their fundamental element, you know, as a left party. And then they need to revisit the strategy of approaching the good euro and start, you know, introducing, even as, you know, threats in the negotiations, Grexit. There are other ones that aren't that extreme. You could introduce a parallel currency, for instance. You know, and I think even people in the Financial Times are suggesting these. You know, Wolfgang Wanchao, who I wouldn't call a radical by any means, he's one of the, you know, commentators on the Financial Times, said that Grexit or a parallel currency is better than austerity. And I think, you know, the Syriza leadership needs to start understanding that as well.
One concern that all of us share is the real power of the neo-fascists in Greece. We know that the police department, for example, the majority of those people support the Golden Dawn Party, which is a neo-fascist party. What is your understanding of the situation with that ultra-right wing in Greece now?
Yeah, so the far right in Greece started gaining traction really, you know, in the early days of the crisis, because they were starting to put out, you know, not just an anti-immigrant position, but a Eurosceptic position. And this is something that's common to throughout the far right in Europe. You know, I think Syriza's strategic decision to talk about a good euro was also a way of counterposing against the far right Eurosceptic position, to say that, look, things don't need to become that drastic. You know, we don't need to resort to authoritarian you know, groups that are going to take our country out of the euro and start forming alliances with Putin, and who knows what's going to happen after that. So, you know, that's how they started gaining traction. You know, they've had support, you know, not just big capitalists in Greece or, you know, even the middle class, but also the working class has turned to the far right. You know, they also are institutionally supported through their presence in the police corps. Half the police corps actually supports Golden Dawn. So this is something, right, that Syriza has to neutralize while they're in power. And I don't think they can be neutralized just by unarming them at protests. They need to be neutralized by promoting a strategy that actually is going to reverse austerity. Because at the end of the day, if at the end of this 4-month, you know, deadline of extension of bailout, the Greek government can't even show to the Greek people that you can reverse austerity through, you know, kind of a left direction, people might start, you know, turning again to the far right. At this point, the far right has been neutralized because of, you know, the popularity that Syriza has. And really, you know, because of some drastic steps that they took in 2013, they stabbed and killed a Greek anti-fascist rapper, in addition to all the murders of immigrants that they had conducted for 3 to 4 years. You know, that killing of Pavlos Fissas, the rapper, was enough for Greek society to say that these guys are criminal, they're hoodlums, we don't want them to represent us politically.
Nantino, you talked about the four-month period we're in now, which is essentially some people talk about as kicking the can down the road, because in 4 months they're going to have to deal with this question of the debt, austerity, whether they negotiate with Europe as a partner or whether they actually use the threat of pulling out. Two questions about that. What do you expect to happen in 4 months? And do you think the left within Syriza and within Greece will be able to push Syriza into a situation where it might actually make a threat to leave the Eurozone?
The second question is a lot easier to answer than the first. I don't think any of us can even predict what's going to happen in a week, because on Saturday, the Greek parliament has to vote through this agreement that Greece made with its Eurozone partners. And so that's when the real test is going to come, is, you know, the left platform, which is comprised of 30 MPs out of the 149 that Syriza has, are they going to comply with this line? There's a lot at stake here, because it's not just voting down on the measure. They might have to step down from the party, and then the party itself might dissolve, and that's the government, right? So then you would have to call for elections. So there's a lot at stake here. It's not just that you can, you know, refuse unilaterally. So I think, you know,
right,
we're
so
going
what you're
to
saying
have
is
to...
those 30 who were in the left, they might be forced to vote with Syriza, because if they don't, Syriza may lose a vote of confidence in the parliament.
They might be, but then, you know, they're going to have to play a kind of hard line in the way that Greece should be playing with the Eurozone, which is that, okay, fine, we're going to comply with this agreement, but you better start listening to us in terms of, you know, retooling our strategic direction. And, you know, not just framing the Grexit debate, as they call it, whether Greece should leave the Eurozone or not, in, you know, these more ideological terms, but as something that addresses people's very real concerns. You know, on Friday, one of the very big concerns was that Greece was losing a lot of money. You know, 1 billion euros had been taken out of Greek banks. And at that point, you know, Varoufakis and Tsipras either could have imposed capital controls, which, you know, was a unilateral measure that could have sped up Grexit, or they could have
said that word again. Sped up what?
Grexit, Greece's exit from the Eurozone.
Grexit. That's yes. What it's called. You used it a couple of times. I wonder what it was.
Or they could have agreed to the agreement. And I think, let me put it two ways. The more generous interpretation is that they know that they were voted on a platform to reverse austerity, to renegotiate the debt, and to remain in the Eurozone. So the Greek populace itself isn't ready to leave the Eurozone. And so you're not going to take that kind of measure at this point. And so you're going to build support in the next 4 months. You're going to start, you know, retooling the strategic debate. You're going to start addressing people's real concerns. You're going to try to start remobilizing the bases, because, you know, the social movements in Greece had kind of taken a dip in the past 2 years. So you're buying time, basically, right? There's a more cynical interpretation too, which is that a political calculation takes into account not just the concerns of voters, but also those of investors. And you can say that Syriza's relationship to investors up until now has been that we're not going to leave the Eurozone at all costs, you know, because, you know, the truth is that in the very immediate term, Greek capital would also take a hit because of the speculative attacks and everything else that could happen in that kind of scenario. You know, the Greek industrial base isn't even strong enough for exports to get that, you know, immediate boost that they would get from a currency devaluation. So, you know, they're going to have to play a hard hand against not just its Eurozone partners, but again, against Greek capital, and saying, look, we're the state now, and we're going to start disciplining you, not only in the sense of doing anti-tax avoidance reforms, which is, you know, part of the key measures that they're going to be doing in the next four months.
What's an anti-tax avoidance reform?
Well, you know, tax evasion has been, you know, off the roof in Greece in the post-war period. And it actually has to go back to ship owners again, basically being able to take their ships away and say, look, you're going to tax us. We're not going to be in Greece anymore. But they even did that anyway without being taxed. So, like I said, there are people, there are capitalists in Greece now who can be taxed, who are going to have to stay in Greece. And I think that's the leverage that Syriza should start using. And it, you know, should act as a left government by using whatever popular support it has to leverage not just against the Eurozone, but against domestic capital itself.
One question is, I'd like our listeners to know where they can go to read more. I know you have a very good article in the Jacobin, and so does that person who...
Kouvelakis, Stathis Kouvelakis.
Also has an article in Jacobin, so people can look there. And what other sources do you would you suggest for people? Websites or anything?
Sure, mm-hmm. Yeah. Jacobin, I mean, has been producing things, you know, once or twice a day. So they can be reading, you know, 24 articles that have come out just in the past 2 weeks. There are so many people who have been commentating on this. I actually think that the pages of the Financial Times are useful. Again, they're not radicals, but they're people who are talking to investors and who basically know what's feasible in the very massive constraints that we face today of financial speculation in a context where states have to balance their budgets. And if you have even people like Wolfgang Munchau, again, I think you should read all his pieces, saying that Grexit is better than austerity, right?
Grexit is Greek exit.
Yes, Greek exit is better than austerity. Then, you know, this is opening the space for those internal battles and seeing that to take hold. Again, you should also be looking at Kostas Lapavitsas, who also was an economist at SOAS, so he writes in English often.
SOAS is the School of
Oriental and
African Studies.
Yes, exactly.
In London.
Yes. Actually, you have a lot of expat academics serving in the Greek government now. So, you know, they're all writing to the extent that they can. You know, there are also the more moderate voices that you can look at as well. James Galbraith, who, you know, was a colleague of Yanis Varoufakis, the finance minister at the University of Texas, very well-known economist. He has been writing on this. He has a more optimistic take on the deal. And, right, he's friends with Varoufakis. He also is not of the radical milieu. So if you're able to get something passed where you can even have anti-poverty measures, I'm sure if you're James Galbraith, that's good. But for the left wing of Syriza, which isn't just a minority, you know, you could say that the parliamentary team of Syriza is to the left of the leadership itself, you know, that's when you can say that there's potential for this debate and the strategic debate to be revisited. So, you know, we should continue seeing what people are doing on the streets. There was a rally last Thursday where people expressed that you shouldn't make concessions to the Eurozone to the point where you can't reverse austerity. So there was the very you know, common phrase that was used even by Syriza prior to 2012, no step behind for the Euro. And so we're going to start seeing these slogans emerge. I think we need to start seeing more popular education, right? Not just rallies, but really, you know, kind of a revival of the neighborhood assemblies that we saw after the occupation of Syntagma Square in 2011. We need to see a left government that's really committed to, you know, popular education of that form, of addressing people's very real fears and saying that, you know, if you don't want austerity, then we together, we need to start thinking about alternatives.
That's very well said. There's one thing to mobilize people, but it's another thing to organize them. So let's keep our fingers crossed that things go in our direction in Greece.
And then, Tina, we'll keep having people follow you. Would you write more in The Jacobin? Are you planning to write more?
I hope so, yeah, you know.
Okay, we'll have you back as we get into the next vote, the
okay.
Next one after that.
Sounds
thank
good.
You very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.